Good afternoon. Ah, my mic just came off. Okay, good afternoon. Today is February 5th, Friday, and I just want to thank everybody for coming today. It's the Judiciary Committee, and we want to thank Alex. Thank you, Alex, for getting people online for us, and Nancy Hemingway, the amazing Nancy Hemingway, and my staff, Kelly Toth. And today we have present with us Senator Keel, Vice Chair Schauer, and Senator Myers, and we think Senator Hughes is on her way. Today, we also want to thank IT support. They're going to be helping us with Teams. So Derek Lale and Tim Banaszak, you guys have been amazing making this committee hearing a lot more productive because we actually get to see people and some of the videotape that we've been grabbing from gavel to gavel. So thanks, KTOO, as well. We grab that tape, and it's going like wildfire, and it's really helping our constituents, especially when the Capitol is locked up. So just wanted to put a shout-out and say thank you for that. As you guys know, we've had to make a little bit of adjustments in this Judiciary Committee, and you guys have been fabulous and amazing to work with. And, again, we had to adjust just a little bit today. Some unexpected things are with the administration, but we're working those things out. In regards to what's on the agenda today, we're going to have SB 14. That's going to be continued next week. Today we have invited testimony from Megan Wallace, the Director of Ledge Legal Services. We have Daniel Dew, who is going to be he's a Legal Policy Director for Pacific Legal Foundation. And we have confirmations hearings on the schedule. And we had public testimony. We thought it was going to be on Senate Bill 14, but one of the staffers got stuck en route, and so we're having to postpone that. But I am going to, if people do call in on public testimony, we're going to go ahead and accept it today just because it was notified here, and I have no idea if anybody is going to come in, call in. None of us did social media or push this at all, but we just think out of respect for those who are potentially online, then they need to have that opportunity to testify. So we've got a few people online that we're going to wait and hear from them in regards to the confirmation hearings. Right now, Megan Wallace is – just a second, Megan. We're going to get to you in just a moment. And then we've got several people, I would say, on the line in regards to the disaster declaration. I would say five people right now. So we may end up getting to them eventually. But we're going to go ahead and start off. Oh, I want to welcome Senator Hughes, and I want to recognize Senator Holland. Thank you so much for coming today. Any other senators in the room or representatives? Thank the staff, too. You guys are – I know you guys work super hard, so we appreciate all of you and the spouses and everything out there. So, and I know the media has a tough job, too. So, okay, so with that, we're going to go ahead. Hey, Megan, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself? Oh, you're in. I didn't know you were in here. Yay! We get. Wow! This is fantastic. Okay, better than I expected. Thank you for coming before the committee. It's a rare opportunity, but you have to follow the protocol, so you get to be here in person, which is awesome. Okay, and with that, Megan, if you could just put your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Megan Wallace. I'm the Legal Services Director. I was invited here to discuss the governor's disaster declarations. As a reminder to members of the public that may be watching from home, my office provides nonpartisan legal advice to the legislature. I'm appearing here today by request, but my opinion on the issues before us remain policy neutral based on my office's best interpretation of current law. Given the novelty of the pandemic, legal jurisprudence on these issues continues to evolve. As you all are aware, on March 11th, 2020, the governor issued his first declaration of a public health disaster emergency. Before going into an extended recess, the 31st Alaska legislature extended the March 11th disaster declaration to November 15th, 2020. Through passage and enactment into law of SB 241, also known as Chapter 10 SLA 2020. The legislature did not meet again and did not further extend the March 11th declaration. Instead, upon expiration of the March 11th declaration, the governor issued three subsequent declarations of a public health disaster emergency on November 16th, December 16th, January 15th, each remaining in effect for a duration of 30 days. The latest January 15th declaration is currently the subject of SB 56, a governor's bill seeking to further extend the last declaration to September 30th, 2021. My office has been routinely asked about the legality of the governor's action in issuing multiple declarations for the same disaster emergency. The Alaska Disaster Act governs the governor's emergency powers in this instance. Alaska Statute 2623.020 subsection C provides that a proclamation of disaster emergency may not remain in effect longer than 30 days unless extended by the legislature. In my opinion, AS 2623.020C is clear that the legislature holds the exclusive power to extend a disaster declaration beyond 30 days. Therefore, only the legislature has the authority to extend disaster emergencies beyond the November 15th, 2020 date, and the governor likely lacked the statutory authority to extend beyond that date. However, this issue is a matter of first impression in our state, and if challenged, it's difficult to predict what a court would do if the governor's actions were challenged in this regard. Our office has been tracking this issue across the country. There's been several instances where similar actions have occurred with differing results. So in Wisconsin, the governor issued a second proclamation relating to the COVID-19 disaster, and the Wisconsin Superior and Supreme Court refused to grant a preliminary or temporary injunction on grounds that the legislature had the power to end the emergency and declined to do so. And so the Wisconsin Supreme Court in a similar instance refused to enter an injunction stopping the governor's second disaster proclamation. In contrast, in Michigan, after an initial disaster declaration expired after 28 days, the governor in Michigan also entered issued a second disaster declaration, and that was also challenged in court. There in Michigan, the Michigan Supreme Court held that given that the statute required the governor to terminate the declaration after 28 days, in the absence of a legislatively authorized extension, the court did not believe that the legislature intended to allow the governor to redeclare the same emergency. So consequently, we've seen courts in other states faced with similar situations make differing rulings. And so if the governor's actions in Alaska were to be challenged in court, it is difficult to predict what that outcome would be. On one hand, the court may look to the Alaska Disaster Act and note that under Alaska Statute 2623.025C, that the legislature may terminate a disaster at any time, and hold that because the legislature had and has the opportunity to end an emergency by law, that failure to take that action doesn't negate the power, or negates the power to claim or to object to the governor's issuance of a second or subsequent disaster declarations. On the other hand, if you look at the language and the definitions in the Alaska Disaster Act, a disaster emergency is defined as the condition declared by emergency or by proclamation of the governor. And in evaluating the governor's proclamations, it's been our assessment that the condition could be described as an outbreak of COVID-19, and therefore, because Alaska Statute 2623.020C provides that the legislature has the exclusive power to extend the disaster, that the governor was not within the power to issue another declaration for that same emergency condition. I will pause there. I didn't have an extensive presentation prepared for the committee, and I'm here generally to be available to ask questions that you have regarding the Alaska Disaster Act or the governor's issuance of proclamations related to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thank you, Megan. That was great. I have three people in the queue already. The only question, and I typically like to take committee members first, but this is a question I've been dying to ask for a long time, in regards to the disaster declaration. One of them, I believe, the November 15th to December 15th, he did it based on hospital bed that at or near capacity. For one, who wouldn't want to, you know, which business wouldn't want to operate at, you know, a good portion of capacity? But I would like to know if he does declare that, don't the people in the legislature have the right to see that data, see the information, you know, if all the hospitals, you know, in the state were at or near capacity, if he declared it based on that premise? I want to know if it was based on an actual premise, an opinion, you know, or what that was based on. You may or may not be able to answer that, but if you can answer that, I believe we have the right to know that. I've been trying to get to that information for months, and I've come up empty-handed by this administration. So I really want to know, don't the people of Alaska have the right to know the premise on which it was declared?
Madam Chair, I cannot speak to the facts specifically that were the grounds for declaring the subsequent disaster declarations, other than what is in the plain language of those disaster declarations. In terms of access to public information used to rely on those, that's really a question for the Department of Health and Social Services or the Office of the Governor. And to the extent that those are public records that are available, they would likely be available to the public.
Okay, and thank you, Megan, but I FOIA'd the information, public information requests that come up empty-handed, so by the administration for all practical purposes. So anyway, with that, thank you, Senator Kill. If you'd go next, that would be great, and then you'll be next in the queue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Ms. Wallace, I'm going to ask you sort of to expound on some legal principles based on your knowledge of Alaska's courts and how they evaluate these things. I share some serious concerns about the serial declarations, and especially how a court might interpret how we ought to understand this notion of the condition that justifies an emergency. I was somewhat concerned at the move from the threat of virus to the presence of a virus when the legislature's initial extension explicitly mentioned the presence of the virus. Maybe I can see that one. But subsequently, the justifications for new disasters or declarations reached a level that I have concerns with, including, I think, in the most recent one, the opportunity to distribute the vaccine, which, while I 100% agree we need to do, isn't a disaster. It's an opportunity to respond to the condition. So help me understand, if you can, and I know it's a broad question, how ought we understand the limitations in the statute that a court might read to what constitutes a condition that justifies a disaster declaration?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that is a difficult question, and as I previously mentioned, you know, it's difficult to speculate exactly how a court might rule on that issue. My guess is that if a court were presented with this issue, one argument might be that for the court to look beyond the governor's explicit reasons or the new reasons for the stated declaration, in the sense that that the governor may not just call and say that it's a new emergency if it's not in fact a new emergency and just a continuation of a response to the same issues or emergency that the state has been previously responding to. And I in my opinion, one thing that the court might look at also is what response did the state have to that new emergency, for example. And so the court may question things like, you know, the airport, the travel mandates, for example. Those don't relate specifically to a vaccine emergency. And so a court may look beyond this, the assertion that this is a new emergency because of this reason, and look at the overall response to see whether or not that it is a true emergency. That's also could be a factual determination, and so there could be disputes of fact regarding what is the grounds for the disaster declaration. So it's a complicated issue that the court would potentially have to wrestle with.
Thank you. I have a different line of inquiry. I'll wait until the other members
Perfect.
Had a chance.
Perfect. Excellent question. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I agree with Senator Keel. It's a good question, and one that I think we need to answer, because I think you're right, Megan, that this becomes an issue of, is it a new disaster? I don't see any new things out of it. There are new conditions, vaccine distribution, other things that make sense to me, that it's that we're not extending this based on it being new. It's just a continuation of things that are happening, and there might be new circumstances. That's a fascinating question. I'd like to get a more direct answer, because I'm kind of leaning that way, that we shouldn't be doing this. And so my question with that becomes, it's kind of what Senator Keel said, where it seems like we're combining some things, where when you look at this, we have both the disaster, so-called, and the things that happen with it, but there are statutory and other things we're mixing here with the response to this, and extending certain things, doing other things that, you know, we're getting convoluted, where you're mixing between the administration and legislature. That's a comment about that, by the way, nothing for you to answer. My question specifically, because it just brings up some really good thoughts. Two of them, and you can answer them in order, and one's easy. Any cases you're aware of beyond the state level, and I know this is considered kind of a state issue, but are there any court cases nationally that are looking to move towards the circuit courts or towards the SCOTUS that you're aware of relating to these kind of issues?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, there's a lot of cases that are moving through different states and the federal circuits on a wide variety of issues. I'm not specifically
to the disaster. What you were talking before is what I should have specified. Any that are related to this topic of the governor's mandates versus legislative power, that's what I'm discussing.
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Schauer, there are a lot of cases that have litigated the power of states or other governors or other governmental, you know, municipalities to issue mandates. And so those issues are a little bit different than what we're talking about in terms of the power to declare the disaster. I'm not aware of any cases that appear to be actively moving towards the Supreme Court on the governor's power to declare, for example, subsequent disasters, but there may be other cases related to mandates that are making its way through, but I don't have any specific information on the trajectory.
And the follow-up to that, Megan, thank you. And I know it's tough. There's a lot of things that are very, you know, opinionated here, and it's law, right? It's the practice of and this can be pretty much yes or no. It sounds like your view would be, based on the statutes and the things that you're discussing here, if it was challenged, and while you don't know what the courts would do, your opinion from a legal perspective is that the legislature would be in the right, so to speak, and the governor probably would would likely lose that case based on your purview, with the caveats. I know you can't answer that question. So basically, yes or no, you think the legislature is on the right side of this issue, if that makes sense as a question. You can expand, but I just really want to, it sounds like that's what you're saying. I want to validate it, is my question.
Through the chair, that's correct. In my opinion, the AS 2623-020C gives the legislature the exclusive power to extend a disaster declaration, and that the governor's issuance of additional disaster declarations for what is arguably the same disaster are legally vulnerable.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, And I wanted to say that's exactly what we read in the memo that you had sent. So we wanted to say thank you. You're being consistent with some of the legal memos that you've presented us. And with that, I'd like to, Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Keel and Senator Schauer, for really doing a wonderful job setting up my question. Appreciate it. So
here to help.
So I guess the billion-dollar question, can we constitutionally legally extend a second time something that wasn't extended constitutionally the first time or legally the first time? So my question is, in order to give the administration the tools it needs in order to have the testing sites, expedited procurement and everything, would the safest way to prevent a court challenge be for us, rather than extending the declaration, would it be safer to give him the tools that he needs by fixing specific statutes? In other words, suspending regulations regarding this or that, so that he can mitigate the situation, the condition that is still in existence and needs to be resolved, rather than risking a court challenge and extending the declaration date itself? Would it be better and safer to protect against a court challenge by fixing particular statutes to allow him the tools he needs?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, certainly the legislature could pass a law suspending or modifying the laws that it has previously passed. There's relatively low risk with the legislature taking that approach. The issue that comes up that I suspect is that there are broad powers that come when a disaster, specifically a disaster, has been declared under the Alaska Disaster Act. So absent an ongoing or a valid declaration of emergency, the governor won't have the same powers under the Alaska Disaster Act to respond as it does under a separate bill allowing for certain adjustments or modifications. I would also add or just note that the legislature also potentially has an opportunity to address the current disaster declaration. The legislature has been known to ratify or go back and approve retroactively actions that have been taken by the governor or the legislature that may have been contrary to law. That might be one option for the legislature, to the extent that it agrees that a declaration of emergency should continue. So there may be opportunities to remedy that prior deficiency, but also to take separate action outside of a declaration. That would be a policy choice for the legislature.
And as follow-up to that?
Go ahead.
So absent of doing something retroactively, would you say fixing particular statutes is safer from a court challenge than just extending the declaration date?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, if the legislature were to take action by law and extend or approve a disaster declaration, that action is not as vulnerable to legal challenge, because the legislature at that point has taken specific action by law to approve and extend that disaster declaration. So while I understand and appreciate the question in terms of whether or not that the instant disaster declaration may have a faulty premise to begin with, that once the legislature takes action to approve that by law, it may have some effect as remedying it. The legislature could also make substantive changes to the disaster statutes to prevent and to clarify that it does not intend for the governor to have the authority to issue more than one disaster declaration for the same emergency. I acknowledge that the statutes don't specifically say that, but at the same time, the statutes do give the legislature the exclusive power to extend a disaster declaration. So if the legislature had intended to allow the governor to just issue another declaration right after the 30 days, it would have never reserved the power to the legislature to approve that extension. So there's a lot of different issues at play that the a lot of different options that the legislature could exercise, just depending on what its will is.
Okay, so we're going to start again with me, and then we'll go to Senator Keel, because this is obviously, in my opinion, the most important topic we are dealing with. The past year, this declaration's gone on almost a year, which I never dreamed in a million years it would happen. The bill only got referred to rules. And thank you very much for your clarification, 241, in regards to that. That was really, really helpful, actually, in Health and Social Services, 241. And the only committee that I saw was between midnight and 2 a.m., roughly, right here in this room, right before it went to the floor. So it was an unvetted bill, in my opinion. A lot of us never got an opportunity, really, to weigh in at all. So, first of all, thank you for that clarification. But I there's a couple other things. First of all, I feel like the legislative branch, the Constitution is so clear. And if you look in Article 7, health, education, welfare, and public education, it says the legislature shall by general law establish and maintain a system of schools open to all children. So we have a real important constitutional duty in regards to education. And I can tell you that a lot of the stats right now are showing 1 in 4 children are suffering immensely. Could be much higher than that because a lot of people are in their homes, schools aren't open and things like that. So that really concerns me. I feel like we're shirking a huge responsibility as a legislature. Also in Article 7, Section 4, Public Health, the legislature shall provide for the promotion and protection of public health. We have a Health and Social Services Committee, and it can meet year-round. I mean, we can have meetings, if as back in our districts and things like that. And I feel like it's so incredibly important. We have finance. We have ledge budget and audit. We have the ability to do this, and I have felt like we've been completely shut out with the mandates and, the health orders and the disaster declarations. We weren't called in, and nobody in the legislature that I know got to weigh in at all, including the finances, which, according to Senator Von Imhoff on one of her videos, was over $5 billion if you include the unemployment and, different amounts of money of COVID that have come into the state. And we have the power of the purse. So this is why this is such a huge issue to me, that we took an oath to this Constitution. All of us did. And so the number one goal for us is just know what our constitutional responsibilities are and that we took an oath to it. And we need to uphold that. And there is definitely blurring of the lines between the three different branches. And so with that, in regards to suspending regulations, this is where my question is coming in. I looked. I think there was more than 110 regulations suspended just in one department. And I was looking at some of them, and I was really alarmed. So I'm not a big fan. As somebody that did do a regulatory reform bill, a lot of that seems to be outlandish because it's almost like martial law. So I guess where I'm trying to figure out in here, I thought that statutes and regulations could be suspended under martial law, but martial law could only last 20 days. Can you just put on the record when the governor has the authority to suspend statutes and regulations?
Madam Chair, so the governor's powers with respect to suspension of regulatory provisions is generally found in Alaska Statute 2623.020, subsection G. Paragraph 1 states that once a disaster has been declared, that the governor may suspend the provisions of any regulatory statute. And so you would have to look at the specific regulation that was suspended and analysis as to whether that was a regulatory provision in an assessment of whether or not that was a valid suspension. My office has generally looked at the health mandates or the mandates that have been issued pursuant to the governor's disaster, and we haven't identified any what's the word I was looking for? Specific obvious constitutional issues.
Yeah, and that's very debatable. I can bring 100 lawyers in here that would say the opposite. So, you know, that's just, and one of them potentially will be on next. So that's a debatable. It's not just an opinion that one lawyer can do, because that is, you know, very, very, very controversial. But my question to you was, during martial law, how long does it last, and what is he allowed to do?
Through the chair, I'm not prepared to advise on the governor's limits of martial law.
Okay.
I haven't reviewed that. I'm happy to get back to you.
Okay, no problem. I did not put that before you, so, you know, ahead of time. So thank you, Megan. I'm happy if you get back with me at a later time. And with that, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe as a preliminary question, make sure I understand correctly. The disaster powers that we've spent most of the meeting discussing, those I understood to fall under different provisions of the Constitution than the Section 20 martial law provision. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's correct.
Thank you. And then I appreciate that. The main question I'd wanted to get into, sort of, Senator Hughes didn't set it up for me perfectly, but it's good enough as a lead-in. Question about some of the legislature's options going forward. In Senate Bill 241, in which we extended the initial disaster declaration, the legislature also delegated on a temporary basis quite a few additional powers. And I guess there's a question in my mind as to whether we retain the authority if we were to extend the current disaster declaration or find some way to ratify its actions. Would there be constitutional issues, would there be legal issues with the legislature pulling back some of the governor's disaster powers? I'll use a super easy one. Under the Disaster Act, he has the power to mobilize the military. He hasn't seen a need to do that. I don't think anybody foresees that as a response to COVID. Could we say, all right, we're going to extend the disaster declaration, but you can't mobilize the military in this one? Or is that a separation of powers issue or some other issue?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, generally, without in a very general sense, because without looking at exactly what you're contemplating, the general answer is yes, the legislature has that power. The Alaska Disaster Act generally provides the authority and the power for the governor to act under an emergency. And if the legislature were to pass a law that limits some of that authority in this particular emergency, because the legislature would be modifying its own law, constitutionally, that is generally permissible.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Anybody else at this point in the time?
Just a follow-up.
Senator Shaw?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's actually kind of a follow-up to Senator Keel's questions. I'm strangely finding myself agreeing with him a lot today, and I think both of us should be concerned about that.
Just
so,
me.
It's a joke, tongue-in-cheek. But he brings up some good points, and one to that, Megan, would be legally, it wasn't really answered, but it wasn't asked, is that would we have to pass a new law? Because I think part of it was talking about if we were to extend that, there's not much we can do unless we had to repass it or strip things out of it. I mean, we would have to do something different other than just take one portion out of it. So that's kind of what he asked. I think it kind of ties into what Senator Hughes is asking about, you know, not passing it and just passing statutory changes that might work. So how would we change that without passing something, you know, different or not that law, if that makes sense? I'm a little confused now because of how that was answered. It almost sounds like we can change the law, but we would have to put something in to do that, a vehicle, correct? I mean, I hope that's making sense as a question. It almost sounds like we can change it, but the process to change it is going to be, you know, we're going to have to put that through here. So the governor can do it, you know, to change things basically via policy in directions, but we can't do that.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, in order for the legislature to modify any of the existing statutory powers that are conferred to the governor under a disaster, the legislature would have to modify those by law. And so as one example, in SB 240, and this is just one example that's coming to mind, but in SB 241, the legislature modified the governor's expenditure authority under the disaster relief fund. So generally, the Alaska Disaster Act provides that the governor can expend from the disaster relief fund to the extent necessary to respond to the disaster. In SB 241, the legislature modified that provision in holding that the governor would be limited to $10 million to expend from the disaster relief fund for that emergency. So that's one example of the legislature by law making a change to the general statutory powers of the governor.
May I follow up briefly? And
mm-hmm.
I understand that, and I'm not, what I guess my question, to make it specific, is that we have a process to follow. So if we're going to do that, it's not so simple as the governor just coming in and signing the pen and telling him to execute a policy portion that he was allowed to do under that authority. But for us to change it, we're going to have to do something, and we have a process to follow that's not as easy, because we have to get it through bodies and committees, or well, maybe not, depending on how we pass this one. I didn't vote for it the first time. That time, I wasn't comfortable with the power of extension, but we have to follow that process. So my question, to be more specific, is we can't just, for example, say we're going to modify it and it's changed. We have a process to follow that's not going to be so simple. So that's what I'm driving at, Megan, is that we have to follow the normal processes where the governor can be much more nimble on his own because of what's available to him. And I want it to be clear, because the way Senator Kill asked the question, the way you answered it, sounds like, yeah, we can change it. But it's not something we can just on our own just change without following the normal process, because that takes time for us to do, and we're under it right now, and we're under the gun for timing. That's really what I'm driving at. Is that, am I framing that correctly so it's a more easily answered question?
Correct. Through the chair, Senator Schauer. Yes, to clarify, my responses to Senator Kiel in terms of the options available to the legislature would be to make changes by law, meaning that it go through both bodies and be approved. I would also note that one thing that I have not mentioned that is relevant now that the legislature is back in session is that Alaska Statute 2623025B provides that, notwithstanding any other provision within the Alaska Disaster Act, that when a disaster occurs during session, that any action not approved by law by the legislature, any action taken by the governor is rendered void. So that comes into play now that the legislature is back in session, as opposed to the prior declarations that had been issued while the legislature was in the interim.
Okay, you guys. We're running really late now. So if we could, Megan, this is excellent. I actually missed that statute, so you've definitely got
us is on that.
Okay, go ahead, and then we're going to have to by 2:15 get our next speaker on, or we're not going to get to the appointments and then public testimony. So I'm getting kind of concerned, but please go ahead.
So, if I just understood what you said, maybe I didn't. Because we're back in session, we have to take action. In other words, the governor would not have the option if the time limit ran out, if he felt like he needed to be able to mitigate certain things, and we haven't finished that and given him the tools, however we might decide to do it. Because we're back in session, he couldn't declare another, he can't do anything unless we take the action. Is that what you were just saying? In other words, he couldn't just do another 30 days. Is that correct? Which, and I'm not even talking about the constitutionality of extending something that maybe wasn't constitutional in the first place, but.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the statute isn't quite that specific. The language specifically says that actions taken by the governor under this chapter after the close of session that are not ratified by law adopted during that session are void. If a disaster declaration were to be declared and it had not yet expired, but the legislature was in session and then ended its session, the governor could no longer act pursuant to that emergency because the legislature did not take action while it was in session. And so, but arguably, because the disaster is occurring now while the legislature is in session, if the legislature doesn't take any action this session, the governor couldn't take further action. The governor has proposed a bill to extend the current January 15th disaster proclamation. It appears that through request to the legislature to extend that declaration, one argument is that he has acquiesced to the notion that the legislature holds the power to extend beyond that date, and it would be my opinion that any further action by the governor to declare another or to issue another disaster proclamation, for the same reasons I said before, but even maybe potentially more so now, would be legally vulnerable to challenge.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap this portion up, but Megan, I want to say under Article 3, Section 20, the martial law, said the governor may proclaim martial law when the public safety requires in case of rebellion, actual or imminent evasion, and he keeps using that word imminent and evasion. I think it's the virus. It said martial law shall not continue for longer than 20 days without the approval of the majority of the legislature in joint session. So to me, I just feel like time and time and time and time again, the legislature is being sidelined. And if you look, we do have education and we do have health. We also have finance. So I really appreciate that you bringing that statute forth. I want to ask my final question right now before we get the next speaker on. But there's health orders, there's mandates, there's declarations. Are those considered executive orders or is that different? Because it says that we can repeal them within 60 days of the legislative session. So I'm just trying to, define the difference between a health order, a mandate, and an executive order.
Madam Chair, the disaster proclamations and the accompanying health mandates are not considered executive orders. Under the Constitution, I believe it's Article 3, 20, Sections 25 and 26, the governor can issue an executive order to make administrative reorganization to the departments of the executive branch, and that is the subject then for an executive order. The disaster proclamations do not fall within that provision.
So therefore, Megan, we cannot repeal, is that what you're saying, the orders or the mandates?
Madam Chair, the remedy to the legislature, to the extent that the legislature wants to end the disaster or to require the governor to repeal those mandates is found under Alaska Statute 2623.025 subsection C, which says that the legislature may terminate a disaster emergency at any time by law. So the legislature would need to pass a bill that terminates the disaster.
Okay, and with that, I want the committee to know that because we only have one bill before this committee right now, and I don't want to waste, we've already had to have ethics on one committee, and twice we've had the council. That's why I'm continuing. So these discussions are going to be continuing next week. So I want you to be very well aware. On Monday, we've asked for Health and Social Services and the Department of Administration to talk about the liability, access to vaccines. Even if we don't have the disaster declaration, we don't have to have a disaster declaration of access to vaccines. So I just find that just an incredibly interesting argument. On Wednesday, we've asked Department of Law again to be here in regards to, what their opinion on approving the mandates and health and things like that. I'm not sure if they're going to be here or not, but we will have people here, whether it's them or not. It's their choice to choose, but we will fill in the gaps in regards to that. And also, we have Senate Bill 14, and we're going to potentially have a public hearing in regards to some of these and the impacts, because people just are completely obsessed with just COVID. Well, there's a lot of collateral damage to education, to businesses, to tourism, to fishing. It's impacting our state, and it's transforming it, and the people have the right to know why these are being declared and where their constitutional rights, end, and where the governor is blurring lines for constitutional rights, for legislative rights, and private property rights. And we could go on and on. That's why I have the people's petition that just lists several things that the people have brought to me in regards to the mandates. But the bottom line is, thank you. We really appreciate you being here today, and we'll probably be inviting you back, okay? So thank you, Megan, very, very much. Really important information we got on the record today. And thanks for all your help writing bills and amendments, and you guys do a lot of busy things over there at Ledge Legal, so you are appreciated. Okay, so with that, we're going to switch, and I'm sorry we're running a little bit behind you guys. We're going to go to Daniel Dew. He's a legal policy director with the Pacific Legal Foundation in Washington, D.C. So with that, thank you so much for coming before our committee today, and if you could just state your name and basically who you're with and then just proceed with your testimony. But welcome to the Alaska State Senate Judiciary.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Daniel Du. I'm the Legal Policy Director at Pacific Legal Foundation. Pacific Legal Foundation is a nonprofit, primarily law firm. We fight for individual liberty, property rights, equal protection, free speech, and all of those good things. We've been around for about 47 years. We've had numerous wins in the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing another one of our cases this term. My job is to work with state legislators and state legislatures so that our litigators aren't quite so busy. And right now, our big push is to help state legislatures reform and put safeguards on governor and executive emergency powers. Because what we've seen is that these emergency powers have been going on we're going into the 10th month now. And I think what has happened is that we are confusing seriousness with emergency. Just because something is serious does not mean that it's an emergency. At the beginning of the pandemic, when we had little knowledge of how it spread, of how lethal it was, and those things, it may have been fully justified for governors to act quickly and unilaterally to protect individuals. But once that lingers on for a while, it no longer is an emergency. It's not an emerging problem. It is a serious issue that the legislature needs to make policy for. That is the job of the legislature. It is to make policy. Justice Scalia used to always say that every banana republic has a Bill of Rights. And then he would read some of the Bill of Rights and they would sound fantastic. And then he would tell you the country that it came from and you wouldn't believe it. And his point was that it is really the structure of government and the separation of powers that is truly what protects individual liberty. It's the fact that we have three distinct branches of government that perform different functions. And so our argument is that after that initial period is over, the other branches need to step in and perform their normal duties and to make policy. I won't go into what's happened in Alaska because we just heard that. But I will say that Alaska is not alone. We're seeing across the country that there are existing restrictions on governor's orders and emergency orders and what they can do. For example, New York has a limitation on executive orders, and so the governor there has consistently just kept issuing new executive orders. And as was mentioned in the previous testimony, just yesterday, the Wisconsin legislature voted to end the emergency order there, and I believe it was within 1 hour the governor reissued another emergency order. So there are these attempts across the country to undermine the authority of the legislature, which we know is the greatest protector of individual liberty. As state legislators, you are much more accessible to your constituents than is the governor. It allows the people to really have a voice in the state's response to emergency. So one of the things that we've been doing is we've been promoting some principles around safeguards that should be placed on emergency orders. The first is that emergency orders should be narrowly tailored, meaning that they are limited in scope, duration, and applicability. That's really important. We had a client in a different state where they owned a nail salon, and the governor had allowed hair salons to open, but nail salons could not. If you're familiar with these businesses, they operate in the same proximity. The nail salons could have easily adopted the same safety protocols that were required of hair salons, but it was just a flat ban on nail salons opening, no matter what they did. So we see this disparate treatment, these similarly situated businesses being treated differently. We've also seen in some states, large box stores being treated better than church services. So there's a real problem with this disparate treatment by requiring narrowly tailored orders that would help with that. Second is to subject emergency orders to expedited judicial review. We've seen courts kind of wait it out and see what's going on. So by telling courts that this is really your jurisdiction, you really have to decide these issues and do so in an expedited manner, that will help them realize that they can't just punt on these things. Something else that we've seen is that it's not just the governor issuing these emergency orders. I am from Ohio, and in my home state, a lot of the orders came from an unelected state health director. And if the state health director wants to help advise on emergency orders, that's fine. But somebody who is politically accountable to the people should be signing off on those orders. The other thing that we've said is that there should be an incentive for the governor to call the legislature into session. So have a short period of time where the governor can issue an emergency order. And then once he or she calls the legislature into session, then that period of time gets extended. But in all instances, they should sunset in a reasonable amount of time. We think that 30 days is plenty, unless the legislature comes in and ratifies those emergency orders. And then the final two things that I'll mention is we think it's important to allow remote participation for legislators to debate and vote on emergency orders. That way, if it's a pandemic, if it's something else, some other natural disaster that hurts the ability for people to travel or gather in one place, the legislature can still do its job. A lot of these emergency management acts or emergency powers acts were written before the technology that we have today. Now it's possible for legislatures to respond even more quickly than they could previously. And then finally, is to avoid what we've seen with governors sidestepping emergency orders, and this was talked about quite a bit with the previous presenter, is that there should be a prohibition on governors, specific, explicit prohibition on governors from reissuing emergency orders or substantially similar emergency orders to ones that expired or the legislature rejected. We think that by adhering to those principles, the legislature can step into the role that the Constitution requires them to fulfill, and also the judiciary. And I'll just say, right now we're talking about COVID, and that's important. That's what's on top of everybody's minds. But we have seen in other places, so for example, 7 states have declared opiates an emergency. We've seen homelessness, racism, climate change, a number of things have been declared emergencies by state and local officials. And one of my concerns is that if the legislatures across the country don't step up and place these safeguards on the executive emergency powers, and I'm not just talking about governors, but also municipal or county executives as well, we'll see that these executives are emboldened and they will declare these, once again, they'll confuse emergency with serious, and we'll see an attempt to govern unilaterally on these different issues. So those are our recommendations. We are seeing these being introduced across the country. Kentucky recently overrode the governor's veto on this. North Dakota is working on this. There was a recent article that came out that said 27 states have introduced legislation to modify and place safeguards on executive emergency powers because there is that recognition that there's potential for abuse. And the final thing I'll say is, you know, these safeguards, whether you love what the governor has done or hated it, these safeguards need to be put in place because, number one, nobody, regardless of how great they are, should be trusted with all of that power, number one. And number two, you never know what the next emergency is going to be or who is going to be the person with the power at that point. And thank you very much for allowing me to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay, first of all, I want to say thank you very much. I want to let all the senators here know that there's a recommendation summary, require emergency orders to be narrowly tailored, subject emergency orders to be expedited for judicial review, and that's part of our committee. Only the governor may issue a statewide emergency order that does not infringe on constitutional rights. Sunset emergency orders in 7 days if the legislature is not in session or called into session. Sunset emergency orders in 30 days if the legislature does not ratify. I'd say support. I don't like the word ratify. We've only used that twice ever. Allow remote participation. This was Senator Schauer's bill, and we just passed it. It ended up being a rules committee, I think, this time, but we just did pass that in the Senate. That was just yesterday, I think. Yeah, last couple days. It said allow remote participation to be able to debate and vote on emergency orders. We never got to see how any of the money was spent, basically. I mean, we didn't get to participate, I should say. We got to see after it was spent, but that's not okay because we had the power of the purses, in my opinion. But I'm really thankful for that remote participation that we tried to get ahead of the game, and I wish we would have. So thanks for your leadership on that, Sir Schauer. Prohibit governors from reissuing emergency orders that expired or that the legislature rejected. I sure wish we could repeal some of them, but we may or may not have that power. I don't know right now, but it sounds like from this person, Megan's, that we may not. But we certainly can end the disaster. And I'm personally thinking, I think that we're creating a bigger disaster in the state educationally, constitutionally, economically, and I could go on and on and on and on. Mental health crisis, that, you know, because the disaster declaration is in place right now. So I personally am passionately against it. I still think vaccines should be made available, but I don't think that this declaration, and I think we need the administrative reg review committee looking at all the regulations. I don't want the governor just deciding, you know, that he can suspend whatever regulations he wants of good laws that we've put into place. So I have a serious problem with the whole bill, Senate Bill 56, but I want to make sure, is there anybody on this committee that would like to ask him a question? Senator Schauer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And a comment, then a question. I do think that while the bill is not before our committee, certainly we're discussing issues of law and executive power, things that relate to judiciary review, including with the courts. So I think it is absolutely appropriate to have these discussions. And, you know, of course, your judiciary committee is discussing some of these. So just from that, from a policy perspective, I appreciate the chance to have some of these debates because they may actually come before us in the bill anyways or in front of the broad legislature. I don't want to get into all of the issues. You had a lot of stuff there. It does warm my heart that you talked about remote operations. We tried to pass it last March because I saw the legislature getting benched, and we didn't pass it. And guess what? We benched ourselves for months when we should have been in the fight. So we're moving that direction now. Hopefully we'll thank you with the other things. Lots of stuff to discuss. But my specific question, to keep it short, is from something you're looking at in other states, do you believe or have you investigated or debated whether or not due process rights are being violated by closing a lot of these, especially small businesses that can't afford to fight or to stay open, just based on that, considering it around the 14th Amendment and due process? Have you debated or thought about that at all and how it might impact that broader issue? Thank you.
So to the chair, Senator, Pacific Legal Foundation, we are litigating and challenging many emergency orders on a bunch of different grounds. And you're exactly right with what we're seeing. We're seeing small businesses affected much more than large businesses and mom-and-pop shops. I was in a committee meeting in Missouri a couple weeks ago where it was a 3.5 hour committee meeting. I had never been in one that long. And it was just small business owner after small business owner coming in and talking about how these emergency orders have not allowed them to survive and how they've been treated so differently than the large businesses. And so I think you're exactly right. That's the reason why this is the Judiciary Committee, so I'm assuming there are lawyers in the room. You know, we specifically in our suggestion used the language to suggest that the courts should apply strict scrutiny to these emergency orders, because you're exactly right. There are due process and those kind of equal application of the law, those kind of issues that are really brought up. But unfortunately, you know, we haven't seen courts. Courts have kind of kept to the sideline. At least they did at the very beginning. Justice Scalia, Justice Gorsuch recently said in a decision, a concurrence, that even if the Constitution has taken a vacation during this pandemic, it cannot become a sabbatical. And so, you know, that's you hit the nail right on the head, and I know that was a really long-winded answer, but the short answer is yes.
Okay, we're going to have one quick follow-up, because we've got a bunch of confirmations today, and then I'm going to go to Senator Keel. I'm going to make a small closing comment. We're going to be – but thank you. We may have you back, okay, especially if our Department of Law and certain individuals that I've been asking, we will be filling in the gaps. If they're unwilling or uninterested, we really thank you for being a nonprofit. And I'm going to really quickly ask you, can you be a resource for everybody on the committee? Can I give your contact information to everybody, Democrat, Republican, anybody on this committee to reach out to you?
To the chair, yes, please. Yes, do.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Schauer and then Senator Keel.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I'll make it quick because I don't think you really need to answer this, but it is a comment related to the 14th Amendment and due process. I have, for example, business owners back home in our district that were, told as we went through this, they didn't want to follow mandates, or they thought they could do their own thing with it, you know, whatever worked for them. But they were, for example, threatened by officials that would come through, for example, and they go to the bar. If you don't do exactly what we say, we're going to take your license. For them, that's a death knell. They're done. And there was no real process for them to do anything other than go, well, then I can't open up and I lose my business. So it's just a comment, Madam Chair. I wanted to get that out there because this is impacting real people who are losing their livelihoods. People are losing jobs. And it seems like you said, it's very unbalanced. Big stores have lots of revenue and things that they can do to survive that. The small ones we're losing, and we're seeing a consolidation of business, and it's affecting many people. And I know that even the senator sitting to my left is seeing it right now from a recent decision that's going to shut down the cruise industry through here, slightly bigger with Canada. But how do we survive this? I mean, it's the cure is becoming far worse than the disease, it seems. So thank you, Madam Chair, for the comment, and you don't need to don't need an answer. Thank you.
Excellent. And that's an excellent quote. And with that, Senator Kerr, you're going to get the final question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In deference to the clock, I won't take the bait on the notion that that legislatures never grab power, only executives do, or that some of those folks you listed as similarly situated for disease risk are similarly situated. We'll leave that aside. I have a question I'd like to ask you to follow up with in writing, if you're willing, and then one I'd like to get an answer in committee, if you would. In writing, if you would be willing to take a look at the definition of what constitutes a disaster in Alaska statute, it's at 2623900. I would be interested in your thoughts on whether that's tight enough to prevent terrible problems but still let us get the job done when we need to save Alaskans' lives. The question in committee, if I may, you talked about an incentive for the governor to call the legislature into session being important in these, and I frankly agree with you. What we saw was Alaska's governor asking the legislature if it planned to call itself into session, and when the legislature didn't do that, the governor, for whatever reasons, did not use his power to convene us, but instead issued serial declarations. Can you talk about how to structure our law or what the right legal approach would be to prevent that kind of problem?
To the chair, Senator, the way that we have set this up, and we have language available that we've worked on, is that what we've said is that, and these days are obviously flexible. You're the legislature. You can decide to do with it what you will. But what we've said is that the governor can issue an emergency order. It lasts for 7 days unless he or she calls the legislature into session, and then that 7 days grows to 30 days. So that way there is that incentive for the governor to call the legislature into session, because otherwise their power is even further minimized.
Well, long as it works, Madam Chair.
Okay, excellent. And you guys, this is just I wanted to let you know that I want all of you. We may end up introducing a committee bill. I have been working on this for about 10 months, but we may, you know, if I would like to talk to all of you all, if you want to enter, you know, a committee substitute in order to discuss all these issues. And that's why we're building on an important foundation, because this, in my opinion, and I think probably everyone's opinion, is the biggest issue. You know, the disaster, the desert declarations, the health mandates, the mandates, what role the legislature plays, separation of powers, all that kind of stuff. So I just wanted to get that on the record right now. But first of all, I want to say thank you so much, Daniel. We may need you in legislative council. I don't know, because we've got some big issues going on there as well. But I will definitely give your contact information to everybody on the committee, my wonderful committee aide that's been talking to you. And it was a privilege and an honor. Thank you for your hard work, and thank you so much for coming before our committee. And we hope to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, we need to move on, and these guys have been incredibly patient. The next section we're going to move into is confirmation hearings. We've got three on the schedule today, and you guys, we gave them, I think we gave you the resumes, and so we're going to get to them, and then I think we have a few people online. We had public testimony. It was supposed to technically be on Senate Bill 14, but there were some adjustments with a staff getting stuck somewhere, and so we're going to postpone that port till next week. But out of respect for the people online, I'd like to give them at least 2 minutes each. So we're going to go through these are really important appointees, though, so I do not want to rush them, but I do want to, out of respect for whoever's online public testimony, we're going to do our darndest, even if I have to ask permission to stay a little bit late in this room. So with that, we are going to go to our first appointee confirmation, Cynthia Erickson. She's the State Commission for Human Rights. Ms. Erickson, please state your name, where you are from, share your background, and why you would like to be reappointed.
Hi, everybody. My name is Cynthia Erickson, and I'm originally from Ruby, raised in the village of Ruby. I live in Tanana for 35 years. My husband is a bush pilot, and we have three children. We own the general store. We've had an airlines, a bed and breakfast, environmental company, bookkeeping company. I'm Athabascan Indian and Yupik Eskimo. I serve on the Suicide Prevention Council. I'm also founder of my own nonprofit, My Grandma's House, dealing with suicide and youth throughout Alaska. I work closely with the Alaska State Troopers and the VPSO program and Tanana Chiefs fighting the epidemic of suicide. I've been on the Human Rights Commission for the last couple years, and I've really enjoyed learning and getting to know a lot of really good people, and it's just been an interesting journey, and I look forward to hopefully being reappointed again. And thank you for having me.
Cynthia, I'm going to see if there's any questions from any senator. It does not. Oh, there we go. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Erickson, thank you for all you've done. It's quite a volunteer resume. Very impressive. I have one question that I'll ask all the appointees for the Commission on Human Rights. This summer, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case called Bostock v. Clayton County that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity is discrimination on the basis of sex. And so the question for all appointees to the commission is, do you have any trouble understanding Alaska's law the way the United States Supreme Court interpreted it?
Gosh. No, I mean, we all have really good common sense. We work together real well. You know, every case that we've studied is, you know, it's basically the same question, you know, what is the law and what we believe in or, you know, in our private life has nothing to do with the cases. And, you know, it's all, you know, abiding by what the law is.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and with, Senator Schar.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you again for taking the time to testify, Cynthia, and volunteer. It certainly takes a lot of effort and work, and a lot of people I don't think appreciate how much it does take this job or others, especially public service. My question to you is there has been quite a bit of controversy with the Human Rights Commission over the last couple of years, and, you know, you've been around and seen some of that. I would like to get your thoughts, and it doesn't have to be real long, just a little bit, on the controversies and the personalities and the issues that have kind of, I hate to use the word rocked, but kind of rocked the Human Rights Commission a little bit. Do you foresee with the current group and how things have gone that will calm itself down? Do you foresee some issues with personalities where there would still be some conflict and things that might make it tougher for you to do your job? And I'm not shying away from hard questions because there's been some pretty, you know, like I said, there's been some controversy and some issues. So I just want an honest opinion on what do you see with the council as far as those issues, and are you guys going to be able to get the job done without some of those things that have kind of popped up here recently? Thank you.
Thank you. You know, it was really hard, especially when you live in a village and coming in and walking in with all the controversy. Whoever makes the appointments, they've appointed some really, really good people. And we're just from every walk of life and with really good common sense, and we work together real well. It's been rocky, but it's been a really good learning experience. I enjoy working with everybody and learning every meeting. They've been really awesome. I think we're you know, we've had a little bit recently, but I think we have a really good board. It's a lot of work and a lot of time, and all of our, it's just all volunteering and flying out of the village and quarantining and going in and meetings and going back home and taking away from your family and work. But I really enjoy it. I enjoy, the group that we have now. And like with any board, there's, with the different administrations, there's people in and out, but I don't foresee any issues in the future. You know, if the governor decides to remove people, or you know, that's his decision, and I think we're doing good.
Okay, and Madam Chair, one follow-up, please. Mm-hmm. And Cynthia, thank you for that. This will be yes or no is fine, or you can expand if you choose, but again, asking questions because some of the things that have happened have caught us on guard. I think you don't always know what questions to ask of people, so I'm just going to ask it this way. Are you aware of, either now or in the past, anybody that has any, for lack of a better term, skeletons in the closet that might come up? And like I said, yes or no is fine, but I want it on the record that there are no known issues that you are aware of with the council, and you've answered it for yourself, that you think would come to light later that is going to catch us off guard, that we go, boy, I wish we would have known that. Can you just or give me an answer to that, please, and then I'm done. Thank you, Madam Chair.
No, absolutely not. I feel that we all are very straightforward, open and honest, and good, hardworking people that really care about the state of Alaska. And I've never associated with dysfunction or dysfunctional people, and I don't plan on getting in bed with any dysfunction. And I really am proud of the decisions that we've all made and worked together. I don't feel there's anything that we have in the closet, and I'm really proud of our board.
Okay, Cynthia, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and say, in regards to the Human Rights Commission and other commissions, anybody who serves in public office, it seems like our speech often is measured and words are weighted heavily. And there's been a recent case of this where the right to defend free speech was the heart of the matter. What was defended ended up becoming an international issue, which has been remarkable to me. But it just seems like there's not much grace on side of conservative viewpoints, and on where, you know, liberals sometimes can get away with a lot more, and they're not annihilated by the media. But you probably don't want to weigh in regards to what recently happened, but I just found it to be pretty, it happened to be one of my constituents. And so that's really caught me by surprise. I haven't followed the issue as closely as I could, but I can tell you at the heart of the matter was the First Amendment. In regards to the Supreme Court, sometimes they come out with rulings, but I can tell you another Supreme Court ruling was parental rights. And in regards to sexual orientation, it was up to the parent and the parent's rights. So you got to weigh all the laws, not just one. In regards to that issue, it's a highly sensitive issue, and there's been cases on both sides. So you need to be very, very aware and measured in regards to that. In regards to who you are, I just want to think, wow, Tana, 35 years. You own a general store. You're Athabascan. I could go on and on and on about what you do with the Suicide Prevention Council and Grandma's House. And I know that there's an overwhelming amount of youth. I know that people in my district can't even get into counseling. It's because the counselors are full. And I think this is potentially a statewide issue, but I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for what you do with youth and suicide in Grandma's House. And I just want to ask a real quick yes or no question, and then I want to say thank you. But first of all, are you seeing a lot more concern at this time where you're from with this disaster and these lockdowns, or is it pretty much the same as it's been in recent history?
Oh, no, it's times 100. I have kids all over Alaska, from Punta Tulia, Napakia, Galena, Ruby, Kaikik, Huslia. I mean, all over. It's just it's really tough on the family. Like I said, I have to fly out, and we're locked down, and we're only flying out for medical reasons. Right now, we just flew out, my mom and dad from Ruby. There's over 25, 27 cases in a little village of 100 or maybe 110. They couldn't go in with the vaccine. We flew them out of Ruby. It's like, go to the airport, use your mask, get on the plane, and get out of there. And we have a lot of kids that are suffering, and domestic violence, and increase of alcohol and drugs. It's a lot of stress. It's really amped up. And dealing with these kids, I do a lot on social media and messaging and talking them through, you know, just suicidal tendencies and just issues at home. And the boarding schools have, you know, only taken half of the kids, so a lot of them are stuck at home. So it's been really, really, really hard, and we're just doing what we can do to keep the morale up and keep it positive and try to go to the light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, Cynthia, thank you. That's what we're hearing across the state: increase in domestic violence, increase in child abuse, economic disaster, education in chaos, drug use, suicide. And thank you. You're doing an angel's work, and we really appreciate you being willing to step up. So with that, thank you very much. And you can either hold on, or you can, or you have a choice whether to stay. If you have any final thoughts, you can stay online, or you're free to go at this time. But thank you very, very much. And next we're going to go to Christy Babcock, appointee for the Alaska Judicial Council from Soldotna. With that, Christy, welcome to the State Senate Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold and members of the committee. I've been appointed to the Judicial Council effective March 1st, and I really appreciate you all listening today and considering me for ledge confirmation. A little bit about myself. I was born in Zambia, Africa, and my family returned to Alaska when I was one. I've lived in Alaska all my life, except for during college while I was in Oregon, and for 3 years while I was outside working in Washington State in the 90s. I grew up in Anchorage and graduated from East High. I attended Willamette University, where I double majored in Spanish and International Studies. And upon graduation, I obtained a job as a legislative aide and traveled to Juneau a week later for the 1990 legislative session. I've worked for the legislature and also for two governors, Governor Hickel and Governor Murkowski, all in the boards and commissions area, including as director of boards and commissions for those two governors. During my life in Alaska, I've lived in Anchorage, Wasilla, Juneau, Kenai, Manilchik, and Soldotna. For the past 25-plus years, I've been associated with State Farm Insurance, and since 1999, I've lived in the Kenai Peninsula, where I'm a State Farm Insurance agent. I employ 8 licensed agents in my office, and my licenses include property, casualty, life, and health insurance. I'm also a licensed mortgage loan originator, and I'm a registered rep for State Farm Variable Products Management Corporation, and I hold Series 6 and 63 securities licenses. I've been involved with several community organizations, from the Boys and Girls Club board to being a teen mom for my children's soccer program. I have 3 stepchildren, 3 biological children, and 2 children adopted from China. My youngest child is a freshman in college. I'm currently getting to know my 11 grandchildren, who are all ages 5 and under. During my 21 years on the Kenai Peninsula, I've dealt with thousands of customers, dozens of other business owners, hundreds of friends, children's friends' parents, teachers, coaches, employees, associates, and acquaintances. I'm proud of the reputation I have as an honest neighbor and an honest businesswoman. I desire to be a member of the Alaska Judicial Council because it represents such an important part of Alaska's system for having a fair and orderly society. We ask our judges to interpret and apply the law and to ensure equal protection and equal justice under the law. We ask them to be impartial and ensure that trials are conducted fairly. Because I have such respect for the role of the judiciary, I'm willing to commit the time and attention required of service on the council. I've studied the transcripts and records of our state constitutional convention, and the founders intended for public members to serve on the council to assist in bringing forward qualified names. Articles 4 and 15 of the Constitution are clear about who should serve and what their duties shall be. I believe I have the temperament, knowledge, and communication skills to work as part of this group in interviewing, studying, and discerning the candidates who have the characteristics to serve as judges. The council also has roles in recommending the retention of judges and making recommendations for the improvement of our system. During my career, whether working in the public sector, in business, or in volunteer work, being able to evaluate information, make determinations fairly, and work with others is something I do regularly and am very comfortable with. I'm committed to serving in this position in a way that honors the constitutional role of the council and the important consequences of the recommendations. I would love to receive your favorable consideration of my confirmation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Christy, wow, thank you so much for that. And I'm going to go ahead and tell the committee I did go to high school with you. East High, I think I graduated a year before you. But anyway, you were a delight then, and you're a delight to this day. Yeah, but I thought it was important to get it out on the record. But we are going to go. Senator Kale, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have two, and the first is a question for Ms. Babcock. Ms. Babcock, as you look at the function of the Judicial Council and how it evaluates applicants for the positions and the things that the council looks at, what would you say are opportunities for improvement?
I didn't hear the last part of your question, Senator. Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question was, what opportunities do you see for improvement for the council to do a better job in how it screens the applicants for recommendation to the governor?
Thank you, Senator. And Madam, through the chair, Senator Teal, I'm really going in with an open mind. My position will start March 1st. So as far as improvements, I won't really know about those until I'm more involved in the process.
One more, Senator Teal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I need to apologize personally to Ms. Babcock. Nothing to do with her qualifications. I think as I read the Constitution, it's not allowable for the governor to forward us another appointee from the 3rd Judicial District. The Constitution requires that appointments be made with due consideration to area representation. And the past appointments he has made will leave vast swaths of Alaska without any representation on the Judicial Council, the entirety of the 2nd Judicial District, I believe. And that's not a reflection on Ms. Babcock in any way. It's a serious constitutional problem with the governor's choice of appointment. And I apologize to Ms. Babcock for her being caught up in that. That's nothing she did.
Okay. And with that, yeah, because Eagle River may or may not be on there now as well. So I understand there's a lot of concerns potentially in regards to who's on finance committee, you know, all that kind of stuff, the representation, I mean, from different jurisdictions. So that it's good to get regional representation is what my point is. So point well taken. And with that, I don't think we have any. Okay, one quick question from Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Same question. Thanks again, Christy. Good to hear from you. But I'm going to ask this of every single person that comes before any committee I'm on, because we have been, again, caught off guard with people that had, again, for lack of the better term, skeletons in the closet that come out later. And then it seems like we're not doing our job vetting. So to do due diligence, and because the record only goes back 5 and 10 years, I'm going to ask, are there any other skeletons in the closet, other, you know, misdemeanors, felonies, anything else that would come out if you were to be confirmed, that we would regret later and not having known about because we didn't ask the question? So I just want to know, is there something of that kind of a level, scandal, you name it, that might come out that the committee would want to know about before we would forward you on? Thank you.
No.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Christy, for coming before Judiciary at this time. I need to take a very, very, very brief at ease because I've got to get I got to find the procedure in order to extend the meeting. So I need everyone just to bear with me just for a moment, okay? I'm going to gavel back in, and with the indulgence of the committee, I'm going to ask if you guys can stay till 3:10 because we've got some people online. I'm going to, if you people in regards to the declaration, disaster declaration, I'm probably going to ask you to keep it to 1 to 2 minutes, and then also have the opportunity to send it to the Judiciary Committee. My staff will get us the correct email. With that, we have one person on for over an hour and a half. And Elizabeth Engel, thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your time. A little bit about yourself and why you'd like to be on the Human Rights Commission.
Hello, good afternoon. Greetings from the frigid north, where it's currently minus 15 degrees here in Fairbanks, where I am located. My name is Elizabeth Murto Engel, and you can call me Betsy. I will turn 79 years old in 2 weeks. I was born, raised, and educated in the Philippines. I have 2 degrees in engineering, namely Bachelor of Science Civil and Bachelor of Science Sanitary Engineering. I came to America specifically to Washington, D.C. in 1967, worked with the District of Columbia designing sewer systems. In 1969, I accepted a 7-month contract with a Fairbanks private engineering firm to do the structural design of the Fairbanks International Airport. More projects kept coming, and I was asked to stay. 18 months later, I married my immediate supervisor, Francis Engel, also an engineer with whom I have two sons and two grandsons. I am registered as an engineer both in the Philippines and in the state, and also as a surveyor. I have the distinction of being the first female registered in the state of Alaska. I was employed by the state of Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities Northern Region for 20 years, retiring in 1999, after which I worked with the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company for 8 years. After I retired from engineering after over 40 years of professional engineering practice, both in public and private sectors, with the last 30 years taking place in Alaska. Some of the notable awards I have received are as follows: the President of Alyeska's Health and Safety Award for Excellence, another award from the President for recognition of 5 years of safe service, Outstanding Silimanyan Award in the field of engineering by my alumni, and in 2017, Women of Distinction Award given annually by the Farthest North Girl Scout Council here in Fairbanks. And in 2018, I was one of the 19 presidential awardees out of 96 candidates. There was a question about skeleton in the closet. The awards that I received were given after clearances from the police, from the National Bureau of Investigation, so I can honestly say I don't have any skeleton in my closet. Why do I want to serve in the board? Well, I really didn't know there was such a thing as the Alaska State Human Rights Commission until I received a call from Gina Ritako, the current director of boards of commission, around March 2019, asking if I was interested in one of the seven commissioners position. I believe I got inquiry after I sat in a dinner with the governor 3 days before that in a function at the Hilton Hotel. Anyway, my response was to give me at least a week to find out what the commission was about, what the functions, responsibilities, and how often do the commissioners meet and where meetings are. Well, as you can see, I accepted the invitation to be one of the commissioners, filled out all the paperwork, and has been an unconfirmed member of the commission for about almost 2 years now. I did so because I think I have a lot to share and contribute to the commission, having held numerous management positions while working with the state of Alaska private engineering firms with Alyeska. I do have a lot of common sense, and I apply it to all, just about in everything I do. Alaska has been good to me, and being a volunteer member of the commission is my way of striving to give back to Fairbanks, where it's my hometown. Some of the volunteer works that I have had in the past are the...
Elizabeth, I don't mean to be rude, but I've got to get out of this room in about 6 minutes. And so we can either hold you over to continue, or you can take some questions right now. We do have your resumes before us, and you're always welcome to send us emails. But with that, can you take a question from Senator Keel, please?
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Engel, great resume, amazing volunteer and professional work, and any recommendation from CB Bettysworth is worth more than its weight in gold. My question is the same as I asked the other nominee to the appointee to the Human Rights Commission. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, writing for the court, said that where it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of sex, that inherently means it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Do you have any problem on the Human Rights Commission interpreting Alaska's law the way the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted the terms?
No, I don't.
Thank you very much.
And also, I want to say that we have a great composition of the board right now. It's a good group, and also we just selected a very competent executive director. So it's going to be a good commission from now on. That was one of the goals I have when I joined the commission. My other goal is to improve the staff working environment. The current location has a litany of repairs and maintenance items. An example is that the office does not meet the acoustical requirements. Clear conversations are transmitted between the mediation room and the conference room. About a month ago, the executive director, Rob Kobashir, and I, as chair of the leasing committee, wrote a 7-page letter to the director of administrative services with copies to the governor's office concerning the condition of the current office occupied by the staff, which is located on 800 A Street, Suite 204 in Anchorage. It is a building that's shared with the Department of Corrections Parole Office Division. These concerns are based on the safety and overall condition of the structure and the grounds, which we believe is a breach to the lease agreement. So thank you for the opportunity to speak before you, and I respectfully hope I have answered your questions, who I am, what I want to be, why I want to be a member, and what I can contribute to the commission, and happy to answer questions.
Okay, Elizabeth, I think we're good with questions. Thank you so much for your willingness to serve, and you're welcome to hold on if you'd like, but I need to open public testimony and see if there's anybody looking to testify. So if you just hold on.
Yes, ma'am.
We open public testimony for Elizabeth Engel, appointee for Human Rights Commission, Christy Babcock, appointee for Alaska Judicial Council, and Cynthia Erickson, Human Rights Commission. Is there anybody interested in testifying in the room? It doesn't look like we have anybody online. So I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. However, I think just I want to absolutely make sure that we don't have to notice this clearly. So I'm going to go ahead just out of extra precautions to hold these over today, because it's been a little bit before we've moved appointees forward. So the vice chairman's going to hold off right now in making the motion, just because I want to make sure. Senator Hughes pointed out that there may be a technical issue, so I'm going to go ahead and hold that. I really want to get to the disaster declaration, people. It looks like we've got four people. If you could stick to 1 minute, if possible, that would be great. And we're going to go ahead and we're doing in regards to the disaster declaration, just because of the way it was worded a week and a half ago almost. So we're going to go ahead and start with open the public testimony about the disaster declarations. Stuart Thompson, if you could say a minute or two, if you speak your, that would be great.
Yes. Can you hear me, Chair?
We can.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Can you hear me, Chair?
Yes, we can hear you. Am I muted?
Good. I'm going to go very fast. To the committee via the chair, thank you for permitting testimony. I am Stuart Thompson, okay. Constituent of Senator Shower.
I'm being asked to hold.
For myself.
Are you okay?
Start of my 2.5-minute prepared testimony that I'll try to shorten up by speaking fast, that may be challenged by other testimony. I recommend you authorize at least another 30-day extension of the COVID disaster declaration, provided the governor does the following. One, comply with Disaster Act Section 2620-150 and provide the legislature with lawmaking recommendations for, quote, the prevention or reduction of the harmful consequences, unquote, of COVID. He should have done this last summer instead of retaining his Disaster Act power of nullifying any statute so long. Two, call a special session just for the legislature to use its lawmaking power to develop and provide constitutionally orthodox law for effectively dealing with COVID. He should have done this last summer, instead of letting an emergency delude him into thinking the executive branch is competent to direct long-term guidance for Alaskans on anything. The vulnerability of an executive engaged in making the law as well as enforcing it to manipulation by special interests is historically well known. Three, direct all public officials to restudy U.S. Constitution Amendment 10, AKA Constitution Article 12, Section 14, to be prepared to defend the Alaska Constitution and the Alaskan people from unsuitable, improper federal government overreach. In my opinion, measures like widespread lockdowns based on scientific guesses, not true verified facts, that commercial and political special interest support by suppressing scientific dissent are the most destructive government actions ever enforced on the Alaskan people. The excuse that such mistreatment is for public safety is sanctimonious hypocrisy. For example, Alaska deaths from causes related to alcohol abuse yearly average over 50% more than Alaska COVID deaths so far by public state statistics. In this crisis, the full power of using the help of Alaskans, literate and basic level scientists from public education has been unconstitutionally neglected. Reference AK Constitution Article 1, Section 1 and 2. Where is a state-funded electronic bulletin board to bypass problems with enforcing the First Amendment on private media companies for Alaskans to be briefed on all proposals, their factual basis, any dissent for study, and for judging what their will is for harvest by legislators? I'm offended by repudiation of our political heritage in favor of benevolent rule of men, not rule of law, by government officials. I petition you to use our constitutions as tools to resolve the problems facing Alaskans and lead us to victory over all threats. Thank you, Judiciary Committee.
Very impressive. Thank you very much for your testimony, Stuart. And feel free to email the committee as well. And thank you for your patience holding on so doggone long. That was a powerful testimony. We're going to move on to Dr. Thomas Hennessy, University of Anchorage. You've got 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. This is Dr. Thomas Hennessy. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. My name is Dr. Tom Hennessy. I'm a medical doctor and an infectious disease epidemiologist with the University of Alaska. And I'm calling in to express my support for extension of the public health disaster emergency declaration to allow the state of Alaska to respond to the COVID-19 epidemic with the kind of flexibility that we need in order to contain the threat. We need capacities for the state of Alaska to administer testing and vaccination clinics in non-traditional locations, and to quickly recruit health professionals from other states, and to more rapidly develop contracts and procedures needed to get the supplies needed for our healthcare professionals and allocate these scarce resources such as vaccines and therapeutics. I think the Department of Health and Social Services, led by Commissioner Crum, has done an outstanding job in responding to this. They put together an excellent team responding to public inquiries and questions to provide information to citizens of Alaska about the rationale behind their decisions. And we benefited from this with the lowest death rates in the United States, high degrees of testing, and low hospitalization. I think we need to give them the tools ongoing so they can continue to do their good work and help protect Alaskans until we can all get vaccinated and end this epidemic. Thank you.
Okay, Tom, I have a lot of questions for you. I cannot ask them at this time, but you may be invited back. Just a really, really quick one because we've only got a couple minutes left. Were you involved in developing the model that the governor used for creating the mandates at the University of Alaska?
I was one of the co-authors of a paper developed last March 25th and presented to the Anchorage Assembly and to the Municipality of Anchorage that evaluated two mathematical models and their relevance for Alaska. And have subsequently done mathematical modeling for the Municipality of Anchorage to help evaluate the impact of various measures done within the municipality. So, yes, I have been involved in mathematical modeling.
Okay, so Mr. Hennessy, you may or may not be invited back, I'm not sure, but if you could please send those to the Judiciary Committee, that would be terrific. And next we're going to move on to Linda Smith. Linda, if you could please state your name, and you've got 2 minutes.
Hello?
Linda, go ahead, from Sitka.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Turn my volume up. I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Hi. Hey, I've been in Alaska 41 years. I am a
commercial fisherman, but I've been a waitress for 35 years and a cosmetologist. I know about the people down here. I'm vice president in Southeast Women in Fisheries. But I think what bothers me is everybody has been doing their part on taking this virus for real. So, I came across this video of Dr. Lee Merritt. She's an MD, and she's been in our military biowarfare. I think what bothers me is that Alaska isn't being honest to the people, and that, you know, we have small businesses closing. We have employees that aren't working. They can't pay their bills, put food on the table. Our fishery out here is closed due to the fact that they're closed down south. Nothing's moving, but there's one thing. Government's getting a paycheck. Teachers are getting a paycheck. The city workers are getting a paycheck. But everybody else, and I'll tell you what, our first responders are those people that stand at the grocery store and that are, you know. Anyways, I want to get through with Dr. Merritt real fast. She's been a physician for 27 years. She's done bioweapon economic warfare. And she says that when you have an economic warfare, you create fear. Well, after 10 years in the military, she's been doing these tests on these viruses. She says people have viruses around them all the time and don't even know it. But we always get the flu every year. And the first flu is always the worst, and then it mutates down to another and to another. And she says, what they've done to this virus here, they have put a spike protein into it, which is a binary protein, and attacks the heart, the liver, the kidneys, et cetera, the lungs. And that's why this virus is so deadly, because she says normally in Mother Nature, without no one messing with it, without no doctors messing with it, and here she is a doctor, her son's a doctor, it just bothers me that we're not educating the people about this. The normal virus doesn't act this way, but the COVID-19 virus has a hook protein into it that was man-made. So what do we have to do now? Well, first of all, they found out that hydrochloroquine and erythromycin acts as a prophylactic, and what that does, when you do get this COVID, you give them this erythromycin or hydrochloroquine, zinc, vitamin D, and C. Get that through their system.
Okay, and Linda, Linda?
It won't attach to the heart and the liver. It will just make it slide off and get, you know, hopefully get you well. I want to know why we're not being honest to the people of Alaska about this. I mean, you can look it up. You can look.
Linda?
This woman said they have been furloughed for almost a year now. She goes, there's thousands of doctors and nurses,
Linda,
that are furloughed. And they're mad because they're saying, hey, these people are doing this for money now. Because if you notice, there was two plants that produced hydrochloroquine. They burnt up for some strange.
Linda, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, we're over 2 minutes now. If you want to go ahead and submit your testimony, I am very familiar with that, Dr. Merritt, Dr. Lee Merritt, her video. So
that's all I wanted to say is please be honest with the people of Alaska. And I want to thank you so much, everyone out there, you senators and everyone out there. Thank you for listening.
Okay, Linda, and thank you very much. I definitely think that Dr. Merritt brings some really good points to the table, but we need to close this hearing out. So thank you very much. We actually are going to be continuing this next week, and I'm going to put it on public record right now. If the administration chooses to not come before the committee, we will modify a little bit, and I'm going to tell you a few things. First of all, Monday, February 8th, we have a meeting here at 1:30 about the COVID disaster declaration extensions. Vaccine availability is what we really want to talk about, how much the state has, what liability do we have if there's adverse reactions, can they access vaccines even without the disaster declaration, informed consent, things like that. And Dr. Lee Merritt video may be an excellent option for this committee, but I'm going to have to put on public record right now that if the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Administration, we will be filling in the gap. So please note that, public. In regards to Wednesday, February 10th, we've got the disaster declaration extension and Department of Law. We want to talk about the mandates, the constitutionality of the mandates, the health orders, etc. We also have Senate Bill 14, which is the only bill that's before our committee right now, in regards to the courts and the Judicial Council, and that will be on Wednesday, and we will also have public testimony in regards to that on Friday. We've also invited the courts on Friday to come before this committee. And we also have an alternative approach, because everyone, you know, you can't just slam someone's plan. I always think it's really important to work for an alternative plan to what the governor is proposing. So that is next Friday. And we're also planning on having confirmations and public hearing for the confirmations next Friday. So it's going to be a busy afternoon. But with that, thank you for your indulgence. I really don't like to run my meeting. This is as long as I've ever run one of the committee hearing over. And thank you for your indulgence, all the staff, everybody here. And with that, we are gaveling out at 3:22.